Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Henry Flagler's Whitehall Estate in Palm Beach is a museum.
Well, I don't think anybody has ever done as much to promote and build an economy in a state than Flagler did here in Florida.
We'll discuss the landmark case Harvest v. Board of Public Instruction.
This is the story of one district judge who faced down a fiery desegregation controversy and created a lasting legal legacy.
This is one of the busiest times of year at Orlando International Airport. We'll talk about the history behind why the airport is called MCO. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Henry Flagler was a wealthy 19th century industrialist before moving to Florida. He was a co-founder of Standard Oil with John D. Rockefeller. Flagler built hotels in St. Augustine, where he established the Florida East Coast Railway. As he extended his railway south, eventually reaching Key West, he continued building luxury hotels and an impressive home called Whitehall in Palm Beach. That home, an excellent example of the Gilded Age in Florida, is now the Henry Morrison Flagler Museum. John Blades was executive director of the museum for more than 20 years.
I think Henry Flagler was introduced to Florida incidentally because his wife was diagnosed with basically tuberculosis. I'm sure that's what it was. And the doctors advised taking her to a warmer climate, so he took her to Jacksonville. Wasn't particularly impressed, by the way. Came back later and was introduced to St. Augustine, and then he thought he saw an opportunity to get involved in what may have been the poorest state in the Union at the time. He just really thought there was a real opportunity here. So transformed St. Augustine and then began to look at the entire state and the Bahamas and Cuba as an opportunity. And so he basically invented modern Florida by creating the transportation that linked the entire state. And by promoting agriculture and tourism, which are still the mainstays of our economy. So by building that foundation, that infrastructure, he made it possible for the Florida economy to really grow rapidly.
Whitehall was designed for Flagler by John Carrere and Thomas Hastings. Flagler had used the architects before in St. Augustine.
Henry Flagler owned many homes. This was very different from his other homes for two reasons. One, he was... about when he started planning, he was about to marry a young lady he'd met in Newport, and she was used to spending time with her friends in Newport in houses like this. So whatever he built here had to compare well with what she'd been seeing in Newport. But I think he was also paying attention to Andrew Carnegie's Gospel of Wealth, in which he admonishes his fellow titans to take at least one of their houses and make it a home for all that's highest and best in literature and the arts as a way of uplifting our society and projecting to the rest of the world that America was destined to realize what Western culture had been striving to be for thousands of years. We're going to get it right in this new world where merit mattered more than anything else. And so that's what this place really is. It's not residential architecture, it's civic architecture, because it is meant to project the aspirations of American society, not the person who lived here.
Whitehall is designed to reflect all of Western culture. Visitors to the Henry Morrison Flagler Museum will notice striking neoclassical architecture, as well as Baroque, Romantic, and other stylistic elements. John Blades.
Whitehall is a reference to a temple to Apollo. It faces due west, which a temple to Apollo has to. He's a sun god. He's also the leader of the muses. It didn't have a formal garden. Temples to Apollo were always in Bacchanalian natural environments. It had one broad walkway up to the house, which was called the Sacred Way. It was always a broad walkway on the way to a temple to Apollo. Six Doric columns, lion heads on the doors, which are also symbols of Apollo, the sun god, because lions warm themselves by facing the sun in the morning. And as you walk inside, we've got this beautiful dome ceiling here depicting Apollo's oracle, Delphi, Pythia, and the nine muses surrounding her. So, you know, it's really, the whole thing's a reference to a domicile for the muses, or a museum. It's actually the meaning of the word.
Campbell Mobley is curator at the Henry Morrison Flagler Museum.
This house is in the Beaux-Arts style, which essentially means that right after the Civil War, many of the wealthy Americans, they would send their sons and daughters over to Paris to study at the École des Beaux-Arts. And they were studying historicism. So that means you're taking the best versions of the of your best versions of homes or rooms in Europe, and you're bringing them to America in a very modern way. You're not copying anything. Instead, you are being inspired by and making it better. And so the rooms that we're in here at Whitehall, they all have cast plaster ceilings. So it allowed this house to go up in only 18 months. This house was completely electrified. And the house overall, it looks much older than it is. Now, of course, it's 123 years old, but it looks even older than that. You know, we're sitting here in the drawing room, which is in the Louis XIV style. And we've got Marie Antoinette cameos above all the door frames and above the mantle. But it was a completely modern space. You know, all the furniture was new. There weren't, you know, these antiques. You know, it was lived in. It was a place that you were supposed to sit at the piano and play. You were supposed to sit on the furniture. You were supposed to eat at the dining room table, that sort of thing.
Whitehall itself is a work of art reflecting the values of Florida's Gilded Age. As the Henry Morrison Flagler Museum, the home is full of fascinating artifacts.
We have a clock from made by Francois Link that's in our grand hall. And I love it for a variety of reasons. One is Flagler was a train man. And so having a standardized time was very important. So I think that clock illuminates that. You know, we have many clocks here at the museum. That one is of particular importance.
John Blades.
I like the gold telegram and the plaques in the history room that were given to him upon the completion of the Overseas Railroad. The gold telegram was given to him by his employees. They were allowed to give up to $5. They put a limit on it. A lot of them gave just 50 cents, but I shouldn't say just, that was still a lot of money in those days. And they commissioned Tiffany & Company in November to produce this elaborate box with a solid gold telegram of congratulations. And it was delivered in time to give it to him in January, which is amazing when you think about it. And then the plaques were commissioned by the citizens of Key West in appreciation and given to him when he arrived there by train in January of 1912. He was, I think, shooting for his birthday, but he missed it by a couple weeks.
The actual rail car that Flagler traveled in to Key West is also on display at the Henry Morrison Flagler Museum. Flagler died in 1913. Whitehall was operated as a hotel until 1959 and opened as the Henry Morrison Flagler Museum on February 6, 1960. Flagler died in his Palm Beach home, but was buried in St. Augustine with his daughter and one of his wives.
Well, I don't think anybody has ever done as much to promote and build an economy in a state than Flagler did here in Florida. No, think about it. There's no other state that's benefited from a single person's belief and investment. Flagler said occasionally he could make more money in New York in 1 month than he could make in a lifetime in Florida, but he was just really interested in Florida. He really thought the opportunity was not going to be realized by anyone but him. And so he just wanted to make that investment to create a way for people to come and live in a place that he thought of as paradise.
John Blades was executive director of the Henry Morrison Flagler Museum in Palm Beach for more than 20 years. We also spoke with museum curator Campbell Mobley. Thank you. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org, where you can find great books on Florida history and culture with free shipping. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, in 2012, the United States District Court of the Middle District of Florida celebrated its 50th anniversary with a two-day symposium organized by attorneys Richard S. Dellinger and T. Michael Woods of the Federal Law Association. The conference papers focused on significant cases in three areas: segregation and integration, civil law, and criminal law. The following year, the Florida Historical Quarterly published the papers along with introductions by federal judges in each of the covered areas, an historical overview by James M. Denham, and an introduction by Dellinger and Woods. In all, 26 authors contributed to the special issue, the largest issue in the Quarterly's then 92-year history.
In today's episode, we will focus on what came to be the most controversial issue associated with school desegregation and the role of Judge Ben Crinsman and the Middle District Court in determining the legal status for implementing busing as a means to achieve desegregation. Attorney Lauren Milcarrick, who graduated from the University of Florida Levin College of Law in 2009 and clerked in the Middle District Court, contributed an article, "History is More Than Black and White," a reflection on the case Harvester v. Board of Public Instruction. The case was heard by Judge Ben Crinsman, a University of Florida Law School graduate and a World War II veteran, who served on the court from 1967 until his death in 1998. As Milcarrick's subtitle indicates, this is the story of one district judge who faced down a fiery desegregation controversy and created a lasting legal legacy. Harvest v. Board centered on Manatee County's desegregation plan that followed after three U.S. Supreme Court decisions: Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas in 1954, overturned the 19th century support for segregation by allowing separate but equal accommodations in Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896. In Brown, the court ruled that, quote, "In the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal." A year later, in Brown 2, the court ruled that district courts, quote, "had to assess whether local authorities were taking steps to admit students on a non-discriminatory basis with all deliberate speed." More than a decade later, in Green v. County School Board, 1968, the U.S. Supreme Court confronted, quote, "freedom of choice integration plans that ostensibly allowed all students the opportunity to choose their school, but in practice perpetuated segregation." In the Kent County, Virginia case under review, only two schools existed, one white and one black. The court determined that, quote, "the freedom of choice plans in and of themselves were not adequate desegregation methods, and the schools could no longer use freedom of choice to blatantly circumvent Brown 1. In 1969, the NAACP filed suit against Manatee County to force compliance with the new desegregation requirements. The county's token plan left 11 segregated schools. In response, the school board submitted three separate plans, two of which were deemed unacceptable. The third plan called for forced busing, which Judge Crinsman ordered to be implemented beginning in April 1970. In February, the desegregation order was stayed, pending an appeal to the Fifth Circuit Court brought by an anti-busing group not fully identified in the court filings. The appeal was based on four arguments. One, the order ignored Florida's pupil assignment law. Two, it violated the 1964 civil rights law against mandating busing. Three, it caused racial disturbance where none previously existed. And four, it failed to consider whether the county operated an integrated system before the order. The court dismissed arguments 1, 3, and 4. On the perceived issue of the prevention of busing in the Civil Rights Act, the court rejected the argument, ruling that, quote, courts need not use busing but were free to do so if necessary to affect their desegregation plan. Furthermore, the court noted that the desegregation order, quote, relied not on the Civil Rights Act, but on the court's inherent powers to correct deprivations of constitutional rights, end quote.
Connie, knowing how busing orders were received elsewhere in the United States, it was unlikely that Judge Krentzman's order and the appeals court ruling would be received without protest.
Milcarrick describes what followed as a one-sided war waged by Governor Claude Kirk against busing. Kirk, the first Republican governor of the state since Reconstruction, was engaged in a re-election fight and used colorful language and the power of his office to support his anti-busing stance. In early April, the governor suspended the Manatee County superintendent, who had started the process to comply with the court order. He ordered Florida state troopers to take control of the county schools. Judge Krentzman issued an order to restrain efforts to interfere with the desegregation plan and ordered the governor to appear in court on April the 7th. The governor refused to appear and requested a continuance. The judge denied the request, reset the contempt hearing for April the 10th, and ordered the superintendent to ignore the governor's orders and go back to work. Three federal marshals and a U.S. attorney arrived in Bradenton to recapture the superintendent's office. Milcarrick described the scene as, quote, better suited to bar rooms in the Wild West than classrooms. In the standoff between the governor's aides and the marshals, both sides refused to give way, and both sides showed their guns. Fisticuffs broke out, and the aides retreated behind a locked door while marshals pounded on it to the amusement of reporters. The governor, in Tallahassee for the birth of his son, told reporters who told him he might be arrested, "I know jiu-jitsu. Don't worry." When asked if he would face off with U.S. marshals, Kirk replied, "Once a Marine, even an old-timer like me, one can take on 100 or anything else." In the end, after protracted telephone conversations, the governor appeared in court on April the 11th. Judge Krentzman held him in civil contempt and fined him $10,000 per day until he backed down and allowed the busing order to take effect. As attention-getting as the confrontation with the governor was, the legality of Judge Krentzman's ruling was the lasting legacy to the case. His ruling was upheld by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and played a role in the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Swan v. Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education in 1971, in which the court upheld the use of busing in desegregation plans. In reaching their decision, the court used virtually identical reasoning in regard to the Civil Rights Act. As Milcarrick notes, quote, "One determined district judge, with proper analysis of precedent and statutory authority, had a hand in the creation of the law of the land," end quote. But she also notes that the social relevance of the case is just as important and often overlooked. In 2012, at the time of the writing, the harvest order was still in place in Manatee County. The students, she argued, quote, "have doubtless been affected by integration. Indeed, the county has maintained a lesser degree of racial disparity than other schools whose desegregation orders were subsequently lifted." She concludes, quote, "while segregation may seem superficially to be parried in the past, it is crucial to remind ourselves that the problem is still very much alive. In Manatee County, however, thanks to the legacy of one steadfast district court judge, that image is both a thing of the past and perhaps a way forward," end quote.
So Governor Kirk's jiu-jitsu skills couldn't stop integration after all. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. This is one of the busiest times of year at Orlando International Airport. Sebastian Garcia has this look at the history behind why the airport is called MCO.
If you have flown in and out of Orlando, you may have noticed that your ticket codes the airport as MCO. Strange, you might think, considering more self-evident abbreviations such as the city's shorthand ORL or OIA for Orlando International Airport. However, the code MCO honors U.S. Air Force Colonel Michael McCoy, who lost his life on October 9, 1957, while piloting a six-jet B-47 bomber that took off from then Pinecastle Air Force Base, today's Orlando International Airport. One newspaper from the time claimed that Colonel McCoy flew the B-47 bomber as a routine flight around the local area. A later report added that Colonel McCoy wanted to repay a favor from his invited guest, Group Captain John Woodruff from the Royal Air Force of England, who took McCoy on an exhilarating flight in one of the Royal Air Force jets. Two other service members accompanied the high-ranked officials in the ill-fated flight, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Joyce, Director of Operations of the 321st Bombardment Wing at Pinecastle Air Force Base, the same unit in which McCoy served as commander, and Major Vernon D. Stuff, Chief of the 321st Bomb Division. Perhaps shockingly, the aerial explosion of the B-47 bomber and the falling debris did not cause other casualties on the ground. Many residents shared firsthand accounts with newspaper reporters of the blast, claiming how the incident, quote, rocked buildings in downtown Orlando, end quote. Eulogizing McCoy, the Orlando Evening Star editorialized how he, quote, had become during his comparatively short stay with us a civic-minded citizen of Central Florida, end quote, contributing to the improvements of road conditions throughout Orange County and providing expertise as an appointed member to the Orlando Port Authority as to whether the city should establish an international airport. He ironically advised against such a plan. The Orlando Sentinel similarly remembered McCoy, adding that in his final moments, quote, the warrior flyer with a great heart went out fighting to protect the people of the city he loved, end quote, by steering the crashing bomber jet away from populated areas. A claim that the Air Force discreetly opposed for nearly 50 years, as revealed in a 2007 Sentinel investigative report that revealed recently declassified records of the crash. Through these crash records, the report further unveiled that the Air Force blamed McCoy for the accident and concealed such a conclusion from even the families of the deceased in an effort to hide the B-47 vulnerabilities at a time when the Air Force needed to display the bomber's strength and readiness for the Cold War. Nevertheless, McCoy's military and civic stature immediately called for renaming Pinecastle Air Force Base to McCoy Air Force Base, which occurred on May 21, 1958, 7 months after the crash, in an official dedication ceremony organized by the U.S. Air Force Strategic Air Command. Throughout the 1960s, the site simultaneously functioned as an active military base, which played a key strategic role in preparation and overseas deployment to Vietnam, and as a civilian airport, commonly referred to as Orlando Jetport at McCoy or McCoy Orlando, abbreviated MCO. A series of amicable negotiations between the city and the Air Force throughout the decade allowed the former to expand its lease of the latter's property, which, by April 1975, the city completely assumed. At the ceremonial transfer, Orlando Mayor Carl Langford pledged to maintain the "at McCoy" phrase in the city's airport name as a, quote, moral obligation, end quote, for the McCoy family and as an acknowledgement of the rapport built between the city and the Air Force since World War II. However, the other appointed members of the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority disagreed with Langford's pledge, and by November 1976, they outvoted him 5-1 to officially rename Orlando Jetport at McCoy to Orlando International Airport, citing that it better reflected the site's recent designation as an international port of entry. The authority decided, however, to maintain the MCO code for the new international airport. McCoy Air Force Base marked World War II veteran Mel Jenner's final duty station before he retired from the service. Mel flew 46 missions as a left-waist gunner in a B-17 bomber aircraft during World War II, which included six over Berlin and his final one at Normandy on June 6, 1944. Mel reported to McCoy Air Force Base in 1965.
I was in maintenance control to begin with and worked myself up to be in charge of the planning and scheduling section. And we were flying back and forth to Guam during the Vietnam War. And I had made two trips to Guam.
Mel commanded the planning and scheduling section during his service at McCoy Air Force Base, which ended in 1968 once he officially retired from the military.
I was in charge for a year or two. I was in charge of the planning and scheduling section. From there, I moved up to the workload control, they called it, I think, at that time. And I would have a radio contact with the flight line. And if any of the airplanes had maintenance problems, they'd call the control room. And I would write a work order and send it to the shops that would send somebody out there to fix it, you know. But it was because of my maintenance background that that worked out real well.
Mel described the physical landscape of McCoy during that time in the late 1960s.
Just like it looks like now. It was a big airfield. They had a civilian part of it was on the other side of the field. Yeah, it was a very outstanding airfield. And the B-52s, they had taken up a lot of the room there at McCoy.
When I asked Mel about the mission of McCoy Air Force Base, he responded with the following.
To be ready. The B-52s, to be ready and for any event. And we practiced it. We had drills, and it belonged to SAC. When I say SAC, Strategic Air Command was in charge.
To listen to Mel Jenner's entire oral history, which includes his incredible service during World War II, visit our recently completed FHS Oral History Project archive at myfloridahistory.org. And I hope the next time you fly through Orlando's International Airport, you have a better appreciation of the deep history that three-letter code, MCO, carries. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.